Hello, everybody, and welcome to Cronscast, the official podcast of SFF Chronicles, the world's largest science fiction and fantasy community. I'm Dan Jones, and this episode I am on my own. Christopher is not around at the moment, so we're going to be plunging on with the episode just with our guest, who is Juliet E. McKenna. She's joining us to talk about Hope Merlee's 1926 novel, A Lud in the Mist. So, hello, Juliet.
Hello.
Juliet is a British fantasy author living in the Cotswolds in the UK. Loving history, myth, and other worlds since she first learned to read, she has written 15 epic fantasy novels so far. Her debut novel in 1999 was The Thief's Gamble, which began the tales of Ainarin. This series was followed by the Aldebrecht Compass sequence, the Chronicles of the Laskari Revolution, and the Hadrimal Crisis trilogy. In 2018, The Green Man's Heir was her first contemporary fantasy novel rooted in British folklore, and this began an ongoing series. As well as novels, she writes a wide variety of short stories and novellas, enjoying forays into darker fantasy, steampunk, and science fiction. She regularly attends science fiction and fantasy conventions and is a reviewer for genre magazines. She comments on book trade issues and has served as a judge for major genre awards. As well as the next Green Man book, she's currently working on The Cleaving, which is a feminist retelling of the Arthurian myth, which is to be published in May 2023. And we will be talking about Hope Merlee's 1926 fantasy novel, Lud in the Mist. Lud in the Mist follows the prosaic and law-abiding inhabitants of the titular town, which sits at the confluence of two rivers called the Dapple and the Dore. The town of Lud is rocked by an influx of what is called fairy fruit, literally a forbidden fruit that is rich with symbolism and which is said to cause hallucinations and sickness in anybody who consumes it. The fruit comes from the bordering land of the fairy, whose existence the citizens of Lud have thought to banish from their thoughts and mind using the rationality of the law. The story follows the town's mayor, Nathaniel Chanticleer, who becomes embroiled in the smuggling of the fruit and uncovers shadowy acts from the past of the town that undermine the town's conviction that the land of the fairy does not exist. And he's forced into a reconciliation of his beliefs. Lud in the Mist has been described as a prototypical British fantasy novel, and despite being reasonably unheralded at the time, it has become hugely influential on the growing fantasy genre and is now considered a classic of genre fiction. And its many fans include Neil Gaiman, who described it as one of the finest fantasy novels in the English language. So, welcome along, Juliet. And, we'll start with our usual question. Why did you pick Lud in the Mist?
I'm increasingly interested in the roots of fantasy fiction. Yeah, it's what I write, it's what I love, it's what I've been reading and working with for decades now. And one of the most interesting developments, I think, in the genre at the moment is the way in which both readers and writers are going beyond what we might call the Tolkien template. Certainly as a reader, I learned to read when I was 3 years old, not because I was any sort of child prodigy, but because I have a brother who is 2 years older than me, and he went to school at the age of five and learned to read, and I just picked it up by osmosis at the same time. So I've been reading fantasy fiction. I started with books of tales of English British folklore edited by the likes of Alan Garner from my earliest days. You know, cut my teeth on things like The Weird Stone of Brisingamen, all of the classics of English literature, children's English literature. And now I'm in my mid-late 50s. There is a limit to what any writer can bring me that is new about a high heroic tale of a quest, a hero's journey, what we might refer to as the Tolkien template. But there is so much other interesting, different fantasy going on at the moment being written, as writers from other cultures, other countries, diaspora writers are exploring the fantasy traditions of their own cultures and bringing in a whole lot of new and interesting and different perspectives writers like Zen Cho, like Elliot de Bodard. And one of the things I'm seeing in a lot of English writers, by which I mean writers who write in English, so some of this is also happening with North American resident writers, is looking at what the roots in English myth and folklore and landscape myth and folklore that has also fed into fantasy fiction, and seeing what we can learn from that. And some of the earliest fantasy tales before Tolkien are actually fascinating reads if you're following those threads back. And for me, Lud in the Mist was definitely one of those.
Right. Okay. Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I think first thing to do, this is probably a question that I'm guessing most of the people listening will be able to answer in some way or another, but it's worth asking, I think, what do you mean by the Tolkien template?
The hero's journey, the quest. Now, actually, Tolkien was doing some very interesting things with the classic quest narrative himself. Primarily, the quest is not to get an item. It's not looking to retrieve the Holy Grail or equivalent. It's actually to destroy,
Item. So, I mean, the hero's journey is not something that Tolkien created. So it's more than that, isn't it? It's not just the basic structure of the novel. There's something else about Tolkien's work, particularly The Lord of the Rings, that made it so pervasive and influential.
Yeah, it's the secondary world, it's the magical elements, it's the non-human races, it's the pluralism of it, I suppose.
Yes,
and also, you know, the archetypal struggle of good versus evil, which actually I think it does Tolkien a disservice to say that is all he is doing. He is certainly looking at that, but there are nuances and complexities in The Lord of the Rings, which I think deserve acknowledgement. Some of those nuances and complexities actually get flattened out in some of the fantasy that was written in the 70s and the 80s.
The copycat stuff.
Yes. There's a point at which some epic fantasy ended up a bit like a 19th generation photocopy. A photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. You lose the clarity, you lose the precision.
It becomes ever more lo-fi, doesn't it, as you filter out the copies. Okay, I think we've got a good grounding there. And I think we'll take that back to Lud in due course. There's one other thing I wanted to just get a definition on, and that was landscape myth and folklore. Now, I see this being a very popular thing as well at the moment. But again, we should probably just play with the definition of that phrase and how it's manifesting in the genre at the moment.
I'm
particularly English landscape myth because I think again that's pertinent to this book.
Yes. Well, one of the interesting things about using myth and folklore as a source is the extent to which it doesn't tell you stories. It tells you incidents. It gives explanations of things. It has small scale, limited anecdotes, if you will, such as, since we've already mentioned the Wizard of Brisingamen, the wizard at Alderley Edge. Now, it's the tale of the farmer who is riding home from market and a wizard stops him and what needs to buy his white mare. And he is taken to and sees sleepers under the hill. And I don't know if I need to avoid spoilers for the Wizard and the British Garment. I'm not sure.
We are fully unashamedly spoiler rich. So we discuss everything with all spoilers all the time.
So the farmer pockets a treasure from the cavern under the hill, and that then kicks off the story. Now, the story of the farmer coming home and the wizard wanting to buy his horse and the sleepers under the hill is a narrative, it's a myth, it's folklore, that actually is attached to quite a few different places around the United Kingdom. And if you think about places like Wayland Smithy, there are all sorts of folk myths associated with that, such as, you know, if you leave a horse there at midnight with a silver sixpence, you will come back and you will find it has a new set of shoes. The white horse from Uffington Hill is supposed to get its shoes there once every 100 years. But none of these are plots. None of these are extended narratives. They are incidents. They are snapshots, if you like. And English myth is absolutely full of these. And they are frequently tied to the landscape because they are explanations of a prehistoric feature, a mesolithic, you know, stone circles. We have the Rollright stones in the Cotswolds, which are supposed to be knights who were turned to stone. And that is a pervasive feature of myth and folklore.
It reminds me of the talk we had a couple of months ago with John Jarrold on Mythago Wood, which
yes,
which is very, you know, it deals with a very similar phenomenon, I suppose, but it teases out that continuing narrative, the hyper narrative or meta narrative out of all of the myths put in chronological order over the history of England, and it plucks out the meta narrative. To which we are contributing even now.
Oh yeah,
and myth-making. English myth has that very peculiar. We mentioned this a couple of months ago about England being a mongrel nation, and that's sometimes used as a pejorative. But we decided that it wasn't, because it was the ability of the English nation to absorb things and then reinvent itself. And everybody who comes to play a part in English history becomes a part of England's story and carries on. People from all over the world and different cultures, and England continually absorbs, reinvents, and carries on. So let's bring it back to Lud then. And so how is Lud building on this landscape myth and folklore, particularly in England then?
Well, it's a liminal place. Mm. It's a place on the borderlands, and because it has this river, Dapple, the river Dapple comes from Fairy and flows to the sea through, what's it called? Place? Dorimar.
Or Dorimere.
Yeah.
So Dorimere is the country, the fictional country, and Lud in the Mist is its capital.
Is the town, that's right. You know, you have the debatable hills, the boundary of Dorimar and the West lay Fairyland. So this is it's a liminal place. It's a borderlands place. And again, that is one of the things that has always been a rich source of stories. Twilight, at dawn and at dusk, it's dangerous. So that, I think, is where the tie to the landscape comes in. And Lud itself is a very, it's a civilized, it's comforting, it's a solid place. And when the narrative takes the characters out of Lud, they get into strange places, the debatable hills. Mm-hmm. And that's where the danger lies. But then the danger comes to the town itself. It starts to undermine and erode the certainties of the people in the town itself. So the landscape, places where people are and are not safe, are integral to the story. The setting, I think, is very important here.
It did seem to me to be a story very much, I think, you use the word borderlands, and it seems to me to be a story about borders itself in the geographic sense, in the geographical sense. So there is a liminal borderland in which Dorimere and the fairyland are kind of converging. But there's also, there are borders around the way that the Luddites, and I do wonder if Hope Merlies was, you know, using that pun intentionally.
I think so.
They're called Luddites, and they're very closed-minded.
Yes.
Which is, you know, this is the other instance of the border. So the border is geographic, but it's also in the attitude and the outlook of the Luddites, the citizens of Lud. They are very closed-minded. They're very fearful of what lies beyond their own borders. They don't have any new information coming into the town other than what comes via the river, which they can't stop. So they use legal frameworks to build up a way of thinking that prevents them from having to consider the strange, possibly dangerous people, inhabitants, information, products that are beyond their physical borders. And that's a problem for them.
I also think the story looks at the extent to which people need to establish boundaries for themselves in what they are and are not prepared to do for themselves, the choices that they make, and also the boundaries that they're going to set in relation to what they're going to accept from other people.
Okay, so let's add a bit of specificity to that then. What are you thinking of specifically in the text about that? You're thinking about Nathaniel?
Yes.
So Nathaniel is the mayor of Ludd.
Yeah.
And he embodies this very structure at the beginning of the novel. He embodies this very strict, structured framework that governs the way that the town thinks. And as he progresses through the book and he uncovers the truth about what is happening with respect to the fairy fruit, so this forbidden fruit that's being illicitly imported into the town, he has to change his understanding of, well, his view of the outside world, essentially.
Yes, but there's also issues with the very odd character Endymion Lear.
Yes, he's the physician, isn't
he's
he?
He's the physician, or is he? And,
well,
yeah, he comes and goes, and he sort of claims authority and is given almost access to various people, which in many ways, you know, why is he trusted? He claims authority without necessarily being entitled to it. As the story sort of unfolds, it becomes more and more apparent that he is a very dubious character. And if people actually had set a few more boundaries, the girls, the women, are not allowed to, in many instances, not allowed to stand up for themselves. They are expected to, you know, basically be good girls and do as they are told.
So that's encapsulated by the finishing school, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yeah. Nathaniel's son, he who basically runs
That's
off
Ranulph, isn't it?
Ranulph, who runs off and explores and goes places. He's a spoiled brat in many ways. So yeah, if he had actually been given a few more boundaries and a bit more structure and not so indulged. A lot of the boys are indulged in this story. Boundaries being set, having the foresight, the self-knowledge to set one's own boundaries, but also to look at where boundaries for other people are being set. Does that make sense?
I think it does. I think that's correct. I would also say that it's about choosing the right boundaries.
Yes. So
because the town is bounded by its closed-minded way of thinking, of
yes,
thinking that the fairyland does not exist. So we've shut that out of our way of thinking. So this, and the fairyland, we don't really see it until in a kind of dreamy way towards the end of the novel. We don't really see it. So it kind of exists as an avatar for the unknown, the fearful, the other, the strange ways of other worlds. So we don't really see it, but as soon as you close your mind off to thinking that those things, you start thinking that things don't exist and they can't affect me, then you're creating the wrong sort of boundary for yourself.
Yeah.
So it's about choosing the right way to bound your thinking and bound your actions.
And then there is the sort of, well, yes, I know what the rules about fairy fruit are, but actually I'm going to make an exception just for me because I'm special. And that's a very dangerous way of thinking.
We were mentioning about about Tolkien before. And there were certain things I thought that directly, I don't want to say informed, because I did talk with one of our friends that on Crons, the Big Pete, who's a voracious fantasy reader like yourself and very, very knowledgeable about the genre like yourself. I thought that there were sort of future echoes of some of the things that Tolkien created. And I thought, you said a lot of the boys were indulged in this book. Yep. And I think that's largely correct. I think there's an exception in the character of Luke Hempen.
Yes, but that comes, I think, in class.
Yes, well,
he comes in there.
I got very strong vibes, Sam Gamgee vibes off of Luke Hempen. Very strong, because he's an undergardener, just like Sam, who's Frodo Baggins's gardener. He is clearly working class. He's very, very affectionate and loyal towards his master. And he ends up in an indirect way being one of the heroes of the story. So I got very strong Sam vibes off of Luke. I don't know whether you think there's a connection there. Pete seemed to think that there wasn't, and I was looking too much into it. But I don't know. There are a lot of echoes there.
I doubt that there is a direct line from this book to what Tolkien was writing. But I would say that both Tolkien and Hope Miralles were drawing on the same wellsprings. You're bearing in mind that Tolkien started writing what became the whole myth corpus, the whole Fall of Gondolin, the ideas that ultimately arrived in Lord of the Rings. Yeah, he was writing those since the First World War. This book was written in 1926. And so both of them are writers who will have been drawing on the tradition of the faithful squire in the sort of high heroic, mythic, medieval romances. That relationship, the hero and his faithful squire, is a very, very long established one. The faithful sidekick, Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson, it's a common pairing. I'm just definitely trying to avoid the word trope. When you see writers, one of the things about archetypes and stereotypes, stereotypes are one-dimensional. Working with an archetype, you can still be working with the same archetype. You can actually make it your own and make it distinctive. And I suspect that's what's going on here.
I thought that Luke Hempen was very distinctive. I think there are a lot of archetypes in here.
It is a book absolutely crammed full of them.
It is, yeah. There's one passage at the beginning of, we mentioned the First World War, and this book was published in 1926. And if you look at the original cover design, which you can find on Google if you do a Google image search for Lud in the Mist, it's very much in the modernist style. And it would have been a contemporary piece of work to writers like Virginia Woolf and T.S. Eliot, who were writing about the aftermath of the First World War.
Yes.
So I think there's something, I do get the feeling that this fear of the other that is characteristic of the citizens of Lud, of the Luddites, there's a line to be drawn there between the aftermath of World War One and what happens in the book. There is a line at the beginning of the novel where Merlies is talking about a Dutchman, she talks about a 17th, the typical citizen of Lud in the Mist was like a 17th century Dutchman who enjoyed the art and the spirituality of colonized people. So the people who had been colonized by his people, and unbeknownst to him, had the same blood coursing through his veins as the people who he believed were somehow lesser than him. Well, that's a précis of what's happening in Lud and the fairyland. So the fairyland is seen as that, well, it's not even acknowledged as existing, but it can, I think we can take it to be lesser, somehow lesser than the citizens of Lud. I thought that particular line had echoes of things like Lovecraft as well, because there's a strong sense of the thing that terrifies you is also running through your, is also a part of you. And I think it's almost like going back to the great line from Solzhenitsyn about the line between between good and evil is down the center of every individual human heart. So yeah. You think that evil is embodied somewhere else, not in yourself. It's embodied in somebody else, in something else, something that's lesser than me. But that's false. It's a dangerous assumption to make. And then you find out that actually it's part of you as well. And so I think there's something going on. I mean, that's a classic Lovecraftian theme. So the stories like The Shadow of Innsmouth and At the Mountains of Madness all have narrators who find out that the monster is somehow in them as well. You know, it's part of their bloodline. And I think there's something going on there in Lud as well. I mean, how closely do you think Lud sits with other modernist texts of the day in drawing on that aftermath of World War One?
I didn't get any Lovecraftian echoes at all, because there is a fear, there is a hostility, there is a I'm not a Lovecraft fan, or for many reasons. What I got from this is, it's in relation to literature of the 1920s, is this is an exploration on how you come to terms with change. Because if you look again at the opening of the novel, Lud in the Mist had all the things that make an old town pleasant. It had an ancient guild hall built of mellow golden bricks and covered in ivy. When the sun shone on it, it looked like a rotten apricot. It had a harbour in which rode vessels with white and red and tawny sails. It had flat brick houses. Not the mere carapace of human beings, but ancient living creatures, renewing and modifying themselves with each generation under their changeless antique roofs. It had old arches framing delicate landscapes that one could walk into, and a picturesque old graveyard on the top of the hill, and little open squares where comic baroque statues of dead citizens held levees, attended by birds and lovers and insects and children. So it had more than its share of pleasant things. So I find that there is a great deal of affection for Lud, it is home, it is a safe place, but change is inevitable, and change is frequently destructive. And if you try and resist change, indeed with the Luddites, and I don't think there is any doubt that
she was using.
I think that was very deliberately chosen, in same way that his master Nathaniel Chanticleer. And that's something else to pick up on in terms of the use of language and style. I think it's coming to terms with change, because a lot of the literature of the 1920s is basically, there has been this complete dislocation from the end of the long 19th century, the golden Edwardian pre-First World War, the long golden summer, and all the rest of it. So I think that is where this fits in terms of that school of literature.
Well, it's coming back to that idea of borders, isn't it? So
yeah.
how strongly do you police your borders, I suppose? Not just geographically, but also how much... I mean, the geographical borders are a good metaphor for borders in general, because they are limits on how much information and how many people you want to let in and out of any one particular place. And you've got to get the balance right, because, as you said, change can be traumatic and catastrophic, but if you don't have any change at all, then your state, or your individual state, or the nation state cannot revivify itself, and so it becomes ossified.
Yeah.
It dies. So there's a... Lud Blood in the Mist, the town, has got it wrong. It's tilted too far in one direction. And it's over the course of the book that Nathaniel Chanticleer, we'll come to him in a second, he realizes that you have to go beyond the thing that you understand in order to revivify yourself and replenish your own state. You're an individual person and the state as well. Now let's go back to Nathaniel then. As you mentioned his name, Chanticleer. Yes. It's an interesting name. It reminded me, it took me back to A-level English when we studied the Nun's Priest's Tale.
Yeah. I think this is one of the aspects of this book which modern readers might struggle with, because that's simply one example of elements in the text that there is a presumption of familiarity with, which I think is one of the things that does date it. I am familiar with the myth of Reynard and Chanticleer because, again, I think I was doing Chaucer in O-level English, and I have read a lot of myth and the like. I would be very interested to know if you did a sort of straw poll of particularly readers under, say, 35, who knew it. Because
I suspect if they're not literature students, the answer would be no.
Yeah, it's surprising how rapidly things drop out of common currency. I mean, I am assuming to you that if I said to you that a place was like the Mare Celeste, you would know what I was referencing.
Indeed, yeah.
Right. A friend of mine whose son is now, this was about 4 or 5 years ago, her son is just turning 30 now. They were actually working in the same place, and they met in the canteen, sort of in the middle of the afternoon, and they were the only people in there. And she said to him, "Gosh, like the Mare Celeste in here." And he went, "What?" And she told me this, and I basically, yeah, my son's Mare Celeste, not a flicker, don't know it at all. And I sort of started asking their contemporaries, "If I said the Mare Celeste, would that mean anything to you at all?" And they just looked at me completely blankly. And I think that this is one of the things that, there are Shakespearean references in this text. There are various references, names that have been used, which inform the text if you understand them, if you know that they're there. I mean, it's not as bad as T.S. Eliot, where you really do need a whole set of notes in the back of the text. Yes. But
even encyclopedia to work your way through a single poem. Yeah,
yeah, quite. But I think that's one of the things that does actually date this and would certainly risks putting up a barrier between modern readers coming to this.
It's a funny book, isn't it, when it comes to the naming of
because
Sometimes you think, well, okay, so there are references to, well, there are references to Chaucer, to Shakespeare, several others as well. There are, I think Burroughs, I think, is referenced as well. Some of the names are just, they're so completely on the nose and overly twee that it goes in the completely other direction sometimes. So I'm thinking of, well, the name Fairyland and fairy fruit is to the modern eye is so on the nose for a fantasy novel that it's almost kind of jarring. And then you've got the funny names like Farmer Gibberty and Diggory Carp. And
yes, it's odd, but again, one of the things that you get some of that reminds me of C.S. Lewis. Because there are, curious jokey punning names in Prince Caspian in particular, which if you have the Latin are actually quite good jokes, and if you don't, they're going to clear the top of your head by a good 6 inches. I mean, it's not one of the other things it reminded me of was Gormenghast. Which again, I mean, I hope Miralles is nowhere near so overboard as Mervyn Peake does. But again, I think it's Peake was writing in
the 60s?
40s.
Oh, 40s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, that is at least when the Titus, the Gormenghast books were actually published. So again, you've got to wonder how long he'd been working on these, how long these ideas had been sort of percolating, formulating in his, you know, as part of his work. So again, I think you can see that this is part of a form of literature that was, that again, they were all sort of drawing on, all sharing the same influences at that sort of period.
In terms of style, there are a lot of literary references in Lud. Yeah. Gaiman, when he was praising the book, he said, Mirrorlees demands a lot from the reader, it's clear, but it's paid over 10 times if you put the effort in and you're able to draw out the references. Which I think is fair enough. But stylistically, in another sense, I think it's quite different from more modern fantasy tastes in the way that the world building is presented. There's a lot of, well, we start with info dump, essentially, don't we? There's a lot of information about Lud, the geography of the place, the rivers, people.
It's in many senses, it's again drawing on the literary tradition that Tolkien and Lewis were drawing on at the same sort of time, because it's an omniscient point of view. It's quite a remote third person point of view a lot of the time. But novels then were. And it is very, very heavy and very, very rich and multi-layered in terms of physical description. And actually, if you go back to the Lord of the Rings, you will find page after page where there is almost no dialogue whatsoever. And again, I think this is a reflection of the times in which it was written, because modern fantasy or modern literature is incredibly dialogue driven. And if you trace that development, you will find that that stems from the prevalence of first cinema and then TV. And the ways in which novels across all sorts of schools of literature started to use dialogue changes with the introduction of visual storytelling through film and TV, that the plot is carried by the dialogue, and that increasingly happens in books as well. Now, 1926, yes, there were films, but cinema was in its infancy.
Oh, there were no talkies.
No. So I think to create the image in the reader's mind, all you have is the words on the page. And that is why you get this very rich, lyrical, multi-layered, full of detail of colour, full of detail of texture, full of detail of scent description that you almost never find in, contemporary literature, or certainly you don't hear it. Get it to anywhere the same extent, and you are being told a story, you're being shown a story, you're being invited into a world. You are not hearing the story being driven by dialogue.
Is that do you think that that mode of storytelling is now extinct because of that?
I don't think it is, because some writers are coming back to it almost. One of the interesting things about storytelling styles is that when something has been explored pretty much as far as it can go, then writers react against it and try and find something else. Now, there are not many writers who can do an omniscient point of view well. It is very tricky to do. Jo Walton is one, for me, who does. I just read, and I've reviewed for Parsec magazine, a novel called In the Heart of Hidden Things by Kit Whitfield. And that's coming out anytime now. And that is a modern fairy tale. And it is set in Gearford, which is a place in England, probably, that could be anywhere from Georgian to Victorian times. And the fairy smiths have to keep the fairies at bay with cold iron. And people are still trying to farm their land and pay their rent and all the rest of it. And they have all the usual tricks, challenges of modern in the sense of post-medieval life to deal with. But there is this other realm as well. And as I say, yeah, this basically has just been published. And it's, again, it's an omniscient, it's discursive, it's elusive. So these things come back. But yeah, there are significant differences in the world building for a book that is doing many of the same things now to the world building in Blood in the Mist. In fact, I would, not wishing to sound unduly harsh, I'm not even sure. I think you're flattering Hope Mirrorlees by saying there was actually world building going on, because in the nicest possible way, I feel a great deal of this book, she just made it up as she went along. Now, yes, to a certain extent, we all do that. But the balance of the narrative structure, the way characters come in and out, the extent to which things are or are not foreshadowed. Bluntly, any editor that I have ever worked with would send this back, you know, this script back with a sheaf of notes about structure, about balance, about coherence of world building. It does not hold up to the sort of rigorous interpretation that I think a modern novel that was trying to do the same thing would be subjected to. And that's not necessarily a criticism, but I think it's one of the indications that actually we need to see this as a piece of writing of its own time, and judge it on its own merits of its own time.
Okay, well, as we will draw this part of the show to a close, we'll just come back to the beginning. So we'll come full circle, because you said that Blood in the Mist is coming full circle itself in a way. I mean, you mentioned that with I've forgotten the name of the book you just mentioned. It's just being published.
Yes, In the Heart of Hidden Things.
The Heart of Hidden Things. So,
and writer is Kit Whitfield.
Whitfield. Okay. So even though a book like Lud, stylistically, is definitely of its time, the themes of these, let's say, elder states books of the genre, they can still provide rich influence and ongoing influence within the confines of the genre and possibly further than that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you are going to pick out themes from this story, you've got the evils of unearned power, you've got the dangers of self-indulgence, you've got how people deal with a threat. And these are all things that contemporary fantasy in many different ways is still exploring.
Well, that's very encouraging, I think.
Yes.
Personally. Right. I think it's a good time to stop. So okay. We will take a pause and we'll join Juliet a little bit later in the show.
Hello, SFF Chronicles. This is James T. Kirk of Earth Starship USS Enterprise. I'm phoning about Mr. Spock. He's useless. Plus, I think he's after my job. So if he phones you, don't heed what he says. I'll give you an example of what he's like. Last Tuesday, the printer on Deck 3 stopped working, and I said to him, Mr. Spock, order some ink cartridges. Pronto. Do you know what he said to me?
Mop, 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 that would be illogical, Captain. Mop, 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 the failure is the result of a paper jam. Mop, mop, mop.
So I told him, know your place, Spock. When I say to do something, you do it. Then he was all like, mop, 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 I'm deadly, look at me and stuff. But he's phoning you right now to give out about me, hasn't he? Oh, he's such a liar.
Who are you contacting, Captain?
Nobody, no, nobody, just making a note in the captain's log. Carry on with your duties, Ensign. Closed door after you.
Sorry about that, SFF Chronicles. Anyway, I'm way better at space exploration commanding than Spock. Over and out.
Hello. Welcome to the Judge's Corner with me, Damaris Brown. If you've been a regular listener of the Cronscast, you'll know I've given talks on legal matters we as authors need to know about, which I've alternated with talks on aspects of the law we can use in our stories. This month is different. The first of what I hope will be an occasional series looking at legal matters found in specific books, starting with the novel discussed in this month's podcast, the fairy tale fantasy Lud in the Mist by Hope Mirrlees. To recap the backstory of the novel, the land of Dorimer and its capital, Lud in the Mist, are ruled by an hereditary merchant class after their forebears overthrew the reigning Duke Aubrey some two centuries before. They govern by means of a senate, but with complete disregard for the separation of powers, and their leader, the mayor and high seneschal, is also the chief magistrate, a position held by the main character, Nathaniel Chanticleer, as the book opens. Although the setting is a fantastical never-never land, it's decidedly English in feel, with the technology and general flavour of the 17th, early 18th century. Fortunately, the legal system the merchants develop, taking as their basis the primitive code of the dukes, is greatly simplified from the reality of those centuries. There are some non-English anomalies in the Dorimerite legal system. We see a murder trial, but although there is a clerk of arraigns, presumably in charge of the paperwork as well as swearing in the witnesses, there appear to be no lawyers involved for either side. Nor is there a jury, but instead the case is decided by the entire complement of magistrates, or judges. Both terms are used interchangeably, though in English law they are very different beasts. And these are apparently also the Senate members, at that point 11 of them. And the murder case isn't brought and prosecuted by the authorities as such. Here in England, it would be in the name of the Crown, in the US, the state or people. But rather, it's an individual who initiates the action and is described as the plaintiff, a term formerly used in civil proceedings. Arrest warrants exist. But in the countryside, these are both issued and executed by lawmen in a mix of legal and constabulary duties, and whatever their other responsibilities, they're farmers and blacksmiths, not lawyers or clerks. And in another mingling of reality and fantasy, a character points out that she can't be tried twice for the same crime. This doctrine has been an important principle of English law, with only minor exceptions, since the Norman Conquest, though after 2005, retrials are now possible for serious offences, such as murder, where there is new and compelling evidence. However, the principle is effectively sidestepped in Lud, because there the criminal charges are very specific as to how an offence is committed, which isn't the case in real life. So being acquitted of murdering someone with the sap of osiers is no bar in Lud to being tried for poisoning him with berries. Notwithstanding these anomalies, it's clear Mirrlees knew something of the real law of England and Wales, and she mentions aspects of the present and past machinery of justice which might not occur to modern writers. For instance, she refers to the fact that it was against the law for the mayor to leave Lud, except on circuit. That is, in his judicial role, he was also required to go into the countryside to hear cases. This kind of itinerant justice, where judges travel on a set path from town to town, has been in existence in England from at least 1170. It originally served a number of purposes, not least saving officials from having to take offenders, witnesses, and jurors all the way to London, and in a greatly modified form it continues to this day. Another instance of the use of real law, albeit strictly historical, occurs when a book causes consternation among the ruling class, and all the copies are burned by the common hangman in a procedure copied from the continent, but first established in England in 1634. Writings had been burnt in public by the authorities long before that. Books by Martin Luther were burnt in 1521 in the churchyard of St. Peter's, for example. But a work by William Prynne so incensed the court that the Chancellor said, "I condemn it to be burnt in the most public manner it can be, I wish it may, in respect of the strangeness and heinousness of the matter contained in it, to have a strange manner of burning. Therefore I shall desire that it may be burnt by the hand of the hangman." And that fate for objectionable or seditious writings continued through the 17th and 18th centuries. In 1795, the printmaker and satirist James Gilray was able to use the idea of it in his work The Crown and Anchor Libel Burnt by the Public Hangman, in order to ridicule William Pitt and other politicians. And while the printer in Lud in the Mist was heavily fined for his offence, he was fortunate in not attracting the punishment which might have been imposed on the author had he been found at the time. That author later says he believes he would have been burned with his book, a penalty which wasn't inflicted in England, though the reality was bad enough. In 1628, one author was beaten, branded, fined, imprisoned, his ears cut, his nose slit, and he was set in the pillory and whipped. But the most important feature of real law, which Merlies uses in the novel, actually forms the wellspring of the plot, the little-known concept of a legal fiction. Mostly, these are pragmatic devices to allow a court to disregard a true fact, which is a hindrance to achieving a desired outcome, by substituting a fiction which softens the rigidity of the law and avoids the necessity of actually changing it. In all common law jurisdictions, courts may extrapolate from precedent or from the acknowledged or inferred intent behind a statute, seeking the spirit rather than the precise letter of the law. So, for example, if a horse were exempt from certain tolls on a bridge, a court might hold that horse was a generic term covering all equines, so a mule could also cross for free. A small extension to serve justice, perhaps, but already the beginning of a legal fiction. That then might be taken further, so in another case a cow is deemed to be a horse, or perhaps if the animals are forbidden to cross the bridge on the Sabbath, a court might deem a particular Sunday to be an extended Saturday to allow it. Obviously, judicial creativity of this kind ought to be kept under close control, and modern real-life examples are somewhat esoteric, and there's considerable confusion in distinguishing such fictions from laws creating principles which might otherwise seem at odds with reality, or where the law invokes legal presumptions to decide a case where the true facts are unclear. In Lud, however, these legal fictions appear to derive not from court decisions but from statute, though since the legislature and judiciary are actually the same people, it's perhaps a distinction without a difference. More importantly, they're not used as means to achieve justice in defiance of a too strict law, but are themselves rigid and very patent absurdities. The most important fiction in Lud arose because the merchants who overthrew Duke Aubrey believed the degeneracy of his court was caused by the fairy fruit brought to him from Fairyland. As a consequence, under the new regime, all things fairy were considered taboo, and in particular, in the eyes of the law, neither fairyland nor fairy things existed. Though, clearly, they did exist, and as with most problems, ignoring them didn't make them go away. That first legal fiction is directly responsible for the second. If the law deems that fairy fruit has no existence, bringing it into the city can't be an offence. Yet the fruit can have a deleterious effect on the people who eat it. Not simply the outrageousness to the bourgeois mind of wild doings under the moon, but also madness and suicide. So the magistrates needed to make possession or trafficking in the fruit a crime. The dilemma was solved by the completely ridiculous legal fiction that turned fairy fruit into woven silk and therefore contraband. This leads to a farcical situation in the novel where the legal action against a woman accused of having fairy fruit, or rather of receiving contraband goods, is clogged by all the foolish complications arising from the fiction, as many days were wasted in a learned discussion of the various characteristics of gold tissues, stick tuff taffeties, figured satins, wrought groganes, silk mohair and ferret ribbons. The third legal fiction seen in the novel is the oldest, found in the first volume of the Acts of the 25th Year of the Republic, Statute 5, Chapter 9, which, incidentally, is similar to the old way of denoting statutes in England, which refer not to the year they were enacted, but to the reign of the monarch. For example, 34 Edward I would refer to an act made in the 34th year of Edward I's reign. The legal fiction is set out in full in the novel. Further, we ordain that nothing but death alone shall have power to dismiss the Mayor of Lud in the Mist and High Seneschal of Dorimere before the 5 years of his term of office shall fully have expired. But the dead, being dumb, feeble, treacherous, and given to vanities, if any mayor at a time of menace to the safety of the Dorimerites be held by his colleagues to be any of these things, then let him be accounted dead in the eye of the law. This legal fiction serves the plot more directly than the others, since by being accounted dead, the mayor can now leave Lud, allowing him to investigate a possible murder and then search for his son, though obviously that could have been achieved without the sheer lunacy of this legal fiction. And once again, Merlies takes the joke further by having him wrapped in a shroud, laid on a bier, and carried to his home by four of the senators in a mock funeral. Merlies is clearly poking fun at the ruling class with these ludicrous legal fictions, but she's also aiming at the law itself, and perhaps not only the law within the novel. Chanticleer's father, in drawing parallels between the law and things fairy, writes that fairy was a delusion, so was the law. It was a sort of magic, moulding reality into any shape it chose. And Merlies adds later, the law plays fast and loose with reality, and no one really believes it. But if she's satirising the law and its failings, she's ambivalent about its use. Chanticleer himself says that the law, with a capital L, is the homeopathic antidote to delusion. And respect for the law ensures that a weak character who is in thrall to a supposed murderer nevertheless allows an arrest warrant against his Svengali to be executed rather than give him warning. And not only are two murderers delivered up to justice thanks to the law, but Chanticleer prevents his daughter being sold as a slave with a strident, "You have no right to do this," since she and her fellow crabapple blossoms are only in the Elfin Marches, and they cannot be sold until they have crossed over into Fairyland itself. His daughter cries, "Father, you have saved us, you and the law." The law is not an ass, at least not always. It also gives protection to the vulnerable. As far as this ambivalence is concerned, I wonder whether it's simply coincidence that the novel was published in 1926, immediately after, and was presumably written during, the great modernising programme of legislation in England, which swept away centuries of arcane and frankly baffling law about land, trusts and estates, culminating in the 1925 Law of Property Act. It's perhaps noteworthy that when Chanticleer saves his daughter and her friends, he finds himself giving a learned dissertation on the law of property as observed in the Elfin Marches. Here, property presumably means personal property or chattels, which would encompass slaves, which the girls would otherwise have been. But it's very tempting to think that news of the 1925 Act was acting on Merlies' subconscious, if nothing more. As well as these points where Merlies is deliberately dealing with the law and legal issues, there are a couple of other legal terms slipped into the novel, though possibly by chance, not intent. Many of the characters have outlandish names, such as Pug Walker and, my favourite, Bold Breeches. But there, among them, is Pie Powders, which might seem just another strange concoction. But a pie powder court was one set up specifically for the duration of a fair or market to deal with all civil and criminal matters arising out of the event, such as brawls or disputes between traders. The odd name of pie powder, in its various incarnations and spellings, being a corruption of the French pied poudre, that is, dusty feet, those of the wanderers and vagabonds who might be found at such fairs. These pie powder courts dispensed speedy justice, often from the nearest pub. From the 16th century, the Hand and Shears in Smithfield was the court for the great annual St. Bartholomew Fair, first held in 1133, which later became notorious for its criminality and general debauchery, leading to a lot of business for the court, until the fair was suppressed in 1855. The second legal term is much more likely to be unintentional, since it's peppercorn, which is a common enough word as a spice. But it's also a byword for a nominal sum in a legal contract, especially as to rent. And for me, not legal as such, but redolent of justice, the name of the suspected murderess, Gibbety, which evokes the idea of the gibbet or gallows, and also perhaps the flippity gibbet, a notorious demon mentioned in King Lear. So there we have Blood in the Mist, a mix of real and imaginary law, with a hefty dose of the utterly ridiculous, a sprinkling of legal terms, and possibly a soupçon of satire, a veritable hodgepodge, which is, incidentally, yet another legal term, and has been since at least 1292. In talking of the novel Blood in the Mist, we simply can't escape the law.
Hello, SFF Chronicles. This is James T. Kirk of Earth Starship USS Enterprise again. I just wanted to let you know that Mr. Spock has been robbing the newspapers from the canteen. You've probably been wondering why the Sligo Weekender keeps going missing. Well, it's because Mr. Spock has light fingers. And I'll tell you how I know it. It's him. Every Monday, he knows the score for all the Division 4 club matches. That's the truth. Try him out the next time you see him. I wouldn't mind, but he's well able to buy his own.
Sorry, Captain, do you mind if I borrow the Weekender? I just want to say you went to the top of Division 4.
No, the Weekender. I don't have it.
But it's right next to you.
Oh, yes. So it is, right. Take it and leave me in peace. I'm busy. There's a problem with subatomic wormhole, and for God's sake, knock the next time.
Yes, Captain.
Anyways, SFF Chronicles. Mr. Spock is a thief, over and out.
We have two writing challenge winners for you this month. The August 75 word challenge was on the topic of water, and the victorious entry, Scarcity and Value, is being read for us by its author, Doug Van Arten, aka Parson. We also have the winner of the July 300 word challenge, a beautiful paean entitled In My Heart and My Roots, written by one of our good friends, Joe Zebedee. Joe's entry is being read by Christopher.
Scarcity and Value by Parson. The asteroid miner Rockhound was weeks from space searching for a golden bonanza when it was holed through both primary water tanks. With only a week's water reserve, Rockhound started a furious search for a big enough asteroid to process for its life-giving water. 5 days later, a right-sized one was spotted, and a desperate computer spectral analysis begun. When the results came in, Spaceman Smith muttered everyone's feelings. We're doomed. It's solid gold.
In My Heart and My Roots by Joe Zebedee. Don't go, they told me. People don't return. But the forest called, in my heart and in my roots, and in the end, I went. Along the dark path into the heart of the woodland, nothing moved, except the air that wound around me, filling my nose, my throat, infecting my breathing so that it became thick and unnatural. Was this what had stopped people returning, this choking? I didn't care, truth be told. Grief had made me detached. The forest's loneliness felt a blessing compared to the inquiries as to how I was coping, the helpful hands bringing dinners to ensure I fed myself, waking to mornings where my dreams had been bare of you. Ahead, a clearing waited, full of mushrooms, the thick air above dancing with their spores. Behind them, something forced its way into the clearing. I knew the heavy-limbed height of you, the shock of blonde hair turning to grey. Where my dreams were bereft, the clearing was not, and you were ahead of me, silent, watching. I could go forwards. That was where the others had went, those who were missing, to their loved ones, and then beyond the clearing. My heart and roots urged me to my feet, but a gentle shake of your head made motes circle in the air between us. I stopped, mid-step. Behind me, I had people who loved me enough to try to feed me, to ask how I was through the lonely days and nights, and the knowledge that you were gone, and I alone. Step by aching step, my eyes never leaving you, I backed to where the air was sweeter. One day, this path would be mine again, in its right time, and you would be there, waiting. But not today.
Hello again, SFF Chronicles. This is James T. Kirk of Earth Starship USS Enterprise. I just wanted to let you know that Mr. Spock has been drinking and partying. And I've got video footage of him singing Smokies Living Next Door to Alice. At 3 a.m, mind you, with work the next day. It's shocking behavior for a Starfleet officer. I don't want to put ideas into your heads, but you should definitely sack him, or write him out of the plot anyways. Or whatever it is you do.
Sorry, Captain. I hope you don't mind me interrupting, but I don't think Spock did anything wrong. Sure, even the Vulcan should be allowed to have a few drinks and a bit of fun.
Not if you're an officer in Starfleet, or any other type of official. And I do mind you interrupting. What the hell are you doing in here?
I was just dropping back to Weekender, and there's an article in here about the British Prime Minister drinking and partying. Seems harmless enough.
That's not the same as what Spock was doing. Because, Ensign, Mr. Spock was drinking and partying in private. The human leader was doing it in his workplace. There's a world of difference over and out.
Welcome back to Cronscast. We are here with Juliet McKenna. We've been talking about Blood in the Mist by Hope Miralles. And now we're going to talk a little bit about your own writing journey, Juliet. I wanted to talk about the Green Man series, and I must admit, I've got my cards on the table. I have a slightly vested interest here because about a year or so ago, I completed a manuscript for a novel called The Green Man.
Aha!
Aha, indeed. And I was scoping around for comp titles, as you do when you're looking to sell, and I came across The Green Man by Juliet E. McKenna. And I thought, oh no, surely not. Not written the same book, surely. So I was very relieved to find out that yours was a contemporary fantasy and part and an ongoing series, because my one is set in the 14th century and is more like The Name of the Rose than anything else.
Right.
So I was very relieved. But there are commonalities between the two, and it's going to go back to that old chestnut we were talking about when we were discussing Ludd, and that's the landscape myth and folklore. Mine is very much tied to, excuse me, the landscape myth and folklore of England once again. And I get the sense that that is a strong vein running through the Green Man books as well. So perhaps that's a good place to start. So could you tell us about the series, please?
It's completely unlike things that I've written before. You know, I have been writing epic fantasy. And it's the evolution of these books, these stories, are completely unlike anything I've done before. The very first seed, acorn, if you like, was I was invited to write a story about The Modern Phase Guide to Surviving Humanity, I think is the title of the anthology, about a story about Fae in the modern world.
Fae Guide, did you say?
Yes.
Okay.
See if I can grab a copy off the shelf.
Well, that's, I mean, again, thematically, that sounds quite appropriate in discussing Blood in the Mist.
Yeah, and I had not a clue. I had no idea what story I might write for this anthology. No inspiration at all. And then when I drive to and from where I live, I pass a stand of oak trees. And one of these oaks is always out of sync with the others. It gets its leaves later. Its leaves turn orange in autumn. They go brown in autumn later. This one tree is always out of sync with the others. And I was driving home, and I think it was Chas Brenchley, writer and friend, was in the car with me. And I made some joke, and he commented about this tree. And I made some joke about, yeah, well, you know, that's obviously got a very lazy dryad. And Chas laughed, and, you know, we went on with whatever it was we were doing. And then I suddenly thought, the other thing that was happening at the time where I live in the Cotswolds was a lot of wrangling about putting a new road through. And this was causing a lot of upset because the plans that certain members of the county council were trying to drive through, which would coincidentally open up a large chunk of land for housing development, was not what anyone who actually lives there, lives around here, wants or needs. We need a different road scheme somewhere else. And this has been going on forever. And I suddenly thought, what would a bunch of dryads do if someone tried to put a bypass through their oak grove? And so I wrote the story in about, and this was literally within 48 hours of the deadline for this anthology. I wrote the story down, you know, 6,000 words or whatever it was, bang. And it just sort of came to me. I sent it in saying, look, this is extremely rough, but if you think you can use it, you know, something we can do with it, then, you know, let me know. And they said, no, it's brilliant. It's great. It's exactly what we're looking for. And so that, I suppose, was the start of thinking about the relationship of the myths and folk tales that are integral to the British landscape coming into conflict with the modern world. And in that story, there is a throwaway line, literally half a line, about if a dryad has a daughter, she is another dryad. But if a dryad has a son, he is a mortal man who has to go out and make his way in the world.
Yeah.
And it's a complete, I say, in this short story, it's half a throwaway line. And that idea would not let go of me. And quite a long time after that, I was on holiday in Ireland, where my father was living and working at the time. He was butler in an Irish country house. And when his lordship and the family were off in one of their many other properties around the world, we would go and have holidays and stay there. And I went out one morning for a walk round basically 1,000 acres of Irish oak woodland. And I was out for about an hour and a half. And by the time I came back, I had the entire plot of the Green Man's Heir in my head. And that has never happened to me before or since. And this book, the idea, the character of a modern working, ordinary working man with one foot in the mundane realities of everyday life and one foot in the supernatural, that he can see into the supernatural, would not let go of me. And the more I thought about it, the more interesting I found it, because I've been reading a lot of urban fantasy ever since it started being written, which is, yeah, 20-odd years ago. And again, to go back to what we were talking about fantasy, when a genre, a subgenre, has been worked on by many talented people who have explored as many of the possibilities, aspects, angles, differences as they can find, which I think has, I think we've probably reached that point with urban fantasy. The classic werewolf, vampire, supernatural lovers of a human female, those triads, triangles, various polygons. I'm not finding a lot new that I haven't already come across. This is not to say that current urban fantasy is in decline. People are doing some very interesting things in it. But for me, I suddenly thought, actually, if you gender flip that and you have a human male surrounded by supernatural female powers, and you do not have to go very far to find umpteen of those in English folklore, from Jenny Greenteeth through to all of the tree spirits, the nature spirits, they're all embodiments of various feminine archetypes. And all of a sudden, you get...
it's a bit like Miss Argo Wood again, isn't it?
Yes. And again, yeah, basically, yeah, I have not come up with this. This idea hasn't sprung fully formed from my forehead like Athena from the head of Zeus. I'm not the first to do this. I won't be the last. But also, I live in the Cotswolds. I live in a very, what externally seems to be a very privileged and wealthy and secure, not to say smug, part of the world. And there is a lot of that. A lot of that is true. Equally, there is a lot of a rural poverty and tension, and there is a definite underclass locally of people who used to find employment in the factories and the farms and the local economy, and most of that has gone. And again, one of the things that I, for me, about writing any sort of fiction, and I choose to write fantasy fiction, is it's got to have some hinterland. It's got to have some. I don't write message fiction because that's as dull to write as it is to read, but a good story has to have texture. And again, looking back at Blood in the Mist, you've got the narrative, and then you've got the themes and the subtext about change and all the rest of it. If you're writing about the modern English countryside, you can explore a lot of other themes and subtexts as well. And again, I'm not the only writer doing this. Liz Williams and the Fallow Sisters novels, they're set in Somerset. And again, you've got this tension between the haves, the have-nots, the countryside, the town, in her writing, that these are all ideas I think we need to think about. And it, in many ways, it's far easier to do that through writing a good story than some polemical blog post or boring everybody senseless on Facebook.
I think that's fair enough. Yeah. I'm aware that we've focused necessarily on England and the folklore and myth of England, with a couple of hat tips to Ireland as well. But back at the beginning, you mentioned that there are people, diaspora writers, writers in, other parts of the world. And we do have listeners from other parts of the world as well. We have, from North America, South America, from different parts of Europe, from Australia and New Zealand. So, let's talk a little bit about how fantasy writers are drawing on things like landscape myth and folklore, but from different parts of the world.
Yes, well, I'm probably not as well read in this as I might be or should be, because one of the dreadful things about being a writer is it takes up all your reading time. Mm. But you've got writers such as Zen Cho. She's written some Regency fantasies, which are absolutely very, very entertaining, where you have the clash of Regency England with Empire. And her most recent novel, Blackwater Sister, is a contemporary fantasy novel, which deals with Malaysian folklore and myth and the intrusion of the supernatural and the fantastic on the modern world and modern individuals. And that is a terrific read. I haven't read Marlon James's Red Wolf, Black Leopard, is it? I can't remember the title.
Black Leopard, Red Wolf. I've read it. I've read that. It's very strange.
Yes, it's on my to-be-read list.
It's very strange. I enjoyed it tremendously. It's outrageously violent. But I thought the richness of the world and the sheer difference of that world compared to what you and I would know very well as European focused high fantasy was what struck me the most, was how different. While we're talking about global fantasy and global SF, I want to think about it from a writer's perspective for a moment. This is something that comes up on SFF Chronicles, on Crons, on the boards, the writing boards, from time to time. People want to write about either characters or worlds that are outside their own heritage. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of a tension there about
it's tricky.
Cultural appropriation. Now, I personally think that cultural appropriation, if it's done well, is actually a good thing, because we should always try to learn and imagine ourselves in what?
Well, I would say if it's done right, it's not cultural appropriation.
Okay, so let's put it that way. That's probably a more elegant
way. I have actually recently been dealing with this directly myself. I've got a novella coming out from Newcon Press called The Golden Rule, and this is steampunk. And one of the things that concerns me is overstating it. I find steampunk a very interesting offshoot of fantasy fiction, not least because I cut my teeth on writers like H. Rider Haggard and King Solomon's Mines and the novels of She and the late Victorian Tales of Daring Do by Fredrod Chaps in parts foreign, that again are one of the precursors to quite a lot of the elements that we find in certainly the more adventurous end of fantasy fiction. And I think we need to acknowledge that. And we also need to, if we're going to look back at those narratives, we need to look back at the very, very problematic aspects of them, because a lot of that is where the white savior narrative comes from. I wrote a short story for an anthology revisiting classics of Victorian literature, and I did a riff on the classic H. Rider Haggard She, Aisha, you know, She Who Must Be Obeyed. And I wrote basically suffragettes taking her on in a story called She Who Thinks for Herself, which meant for the first time in decades, I went back and read the original. And ye gods, the racism and the imperial mindset. And this is one of the things that if this is embraced without thinking it through as part of a steampunk aesthetic, that way lie a lot of problems and pitfalls. So if I'm going to write a steampunk story, I am going to look at it from the point of view of not the empire builders, but the people who got the empire trundling wholesale across their lands, cultures, and all the rest of it. Now, that is quite a challenging thing for me as a white, middle-class British woman, because I'm not English, I'm half Irish. that is a tricky thing for me to do. But the fact that the version of English history I learnt at my Granny McKenna's knee is so wildly divergent from the version of English history that I learnt at a girls' grammar school in Troubadour, Dorset, actually gives me a starting point. But I still have to be very, very careful. So when I'm writing The Golden Rule, this novella, it's coming out from Newcom Press, in which various members of, there are African characters, there are Chinese characters, there are South Asian characters. I have to be very, very careful. Now, I've done all my research. I have looked at my sources in written narratives and all the rest of it. But when I wrote it, when I had it finished, and I thought, yeah, okay, I think I've got this right, the first person who read it, who wasn't me, was a very good friend of mine who is Nigerian Jamaican. And she is an extremely astute, she reads and critiques in crime fiction rather than fantasy, but she reads science fiction fantasy as well. And we've been friends for many years, and I handed this to her, said, please, will you read it and tell me what I have got wrong? Tell me, you know, where I need to dial things back, where I've got the balance wrong. Because, yes, I think it is perfectly legitimate for me as a white English British writer to write a critique of British Empire mentality through a steampunk novella. But I need to double check. Now, sensitivity reader is a very, we
contentious
need
phrase, isn't it? Yeah.
We need a better term, because one of the things, I've had it about when English people have said crass things about the Irish. Don't be so sensitive. And it's a dismissal. It's a negation. It's a invalidating your point of view. So I think sensitivity reader, but it's fact checking. It's accuracy.
Well, what was your friend's response to the manuscript?
She was happy with it. She thought I'd done a good job. In some sense, in a couple of places, she actually thought I could have gone harder.
Mm.
And that was interesting because she thought in some places I could have gone harder, whereas my actual editor in the same places was a bit sort of, oh, do you think we might dial this back a bit? So there was a balance to be found.
Well, it's interesting. I remember the chat we had with Tade Thompson a few months ago. We were talking about Watchmen, but we also spoke about a lot of his work as well. And he was of the opinion that you say what you've got to say, you know.
Yeah.
And there are bad eggs in every population in every part of the world, and if you're trying to sugarcoat, he said he had a lot of good things to say about Japanese manga and anime comics and literature, because they don't sugarcoat it. You know, if somebody is a racist, then they're going to write that character is a racist. They don't sugarcoat it. They don't try and patronize. And he was a big fan of that. And he said, if you're going to write something, don't feel like you have to be sugarcoating it all the time. Which I thought was, you know, that's interesting as well. But I asked the question about your friend, because my assumption was that she, whatever her opinion of it, she wasn't going to come back and attack you for it. And I think
she wouldn't have attacked me, but if she would have attacked the writing, if the writing was wrong. And that's why, of all the people I know, I gave the book to her, because I could trust her to do that.
Well, there's a difference, isn't it, between separating the writer from the writing?
Yes.
Isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people, you know, it's that's sometimes that line gets blurred, which is a mistake. I also think that you can tell, well, most of the time, one can tell if something's being written in good faith or bad faith. And I don't think you can really define what that is, but I'm reminded of that that quote from the American Supreme Court judge, I forget the name, who said, I can't give you a definition of pornography, but I know it when I see it.
Yeah.
And I think it's a bit like that. If you can tell when somebody is writing something in good faith, and if they get something wrong, then you can criticize, but it doesn't warrant an attack. So from the perspective of aspiring writers, especially the ones that I mentioned, because we do get this question coming up occasionally on the boards, which I think is a sign of good faith in itself.
The fact
that people are asking the question. My take is it's similar to Tade Thompson's. You got to write what you got to write. You know, if it's in you, get it down on the page, and you can, like you've done, you can check it afterwards. See, you know, is it going too far? Can you go harder? Like you said, you know, are you sugarcoating it too much? Or it's an interesting balance. But I think my
touchstone has always been, the further something that I am writing is from my own lived experience, the more work I have to do and the more I have to listen. In one of my fantasy novels, or the fantasy trilogy, The Lascari Revolution, there is a character who is one of the main point of view characters, and he has what is in modern terms, he has cerebral palsy. And he's basically, his speech is unaffected, but he has very, very limited mobility. And he is based on a friend of mine in those aspects, a friend of mine from my teenage years, somebody I knew at school, or when I was at school. And so I was reasonably sure that I could draw on things he'd said and his experiences. But I also went out and looked for books, blog posts, comments, articles by wheelchair users and contemporary people to find out basically what they thought, what they felt, the things that really annoyed them. because this was, as I say, this was very far from my own lived experience. So I had the further something is away from your own lived experience, the more work you have to do. And again, I run these things past a friend who is a wheelchair user, and got a few comments and, you know, tweaked things here and there, and overall have had very positive feedback because I have done the work. I have been respectful. I probably have, you know, there inevitably will have been things that I missed, but also because this was part of a wider story. I was not writing a story about what it is like to be a wheelchair user. I had a character who effectively was in that situation as part of a wider story. And I think that is important as well. That
this wasn't the central character then?
Yeah, he was. He's one of the main point of view characters.
Right, okay.
And yeah, he has to get, for plot purposes, he has to get passed over for inheriting because he is physically incapable of being a duke on horseback. So that's, you know, that's the driving motive. But having made that decision, I had to get that character right to be respectful of people for whom that was a day-to-day reality.
So tell us, what have you got? What are you working on at the moment? What's on the
pipeline? Well, the new Green Man book is with my editor at the moment. And that's we have yet to announce the title or indeed the cover art. That's all work in hand.
I do like the cover art for the Green Man books.
Wales.
Sorry, I have to say I do like the cover art to the Green Man books.
The cover art is absolutely
really lovely. And
Ben Baldwin is a genius. I don't know how he does it because you know, he likes to read the books, so he gets the manuscript well ahead of time. And he will send me some sketches and we will sort of discuss, you know, which character, which figure from the story he's going to illustrate. And he will send me some sketches and I will sort of say, yeah, no, maybe tweak this, that, the other. Yes, you got it. How he can tune in to my brain the extent he does. I can't wait to see what he's going to do for the next one. New one set in Wales. North Wales, and again, the landscape is integral to the story in some very, very interesting ways. I mean, I look at landscape very differently now since I started writing these books. It's curious.
Well, we're blessed, really, in the UK, aren't we, with some of these ancient landscapes.
Yes,
well, like the Cotswolds and North Wales and
well, one of the interesting things about North Wales is the extent to which it isn't an ancient landscape, but it is a very much a man-made landscape.
Go on. How does this influence the tale then?
Because if you look at the history of North Wales and the quarrying and the slate quarrying, until relatively recently, and this was an industrial landscape. A lot of North Wales is now a post-industrial landscape and it looks bleak and remote and all the rest of it. Well, again, if you're thinking about spirits of place, which so many of the myths of any part of the British Isles, the myths are about spirits of place, spirits of mountain, tree, lake, river. How are they going to deal with particularly if these are long-lived, eternal, unchanging spirits of place, people coming in and changing their place all around them. And that's as much as I'm going to say about the new book.
Fair enough. No, it sounds intriguing. Okay. I think
it was fascinating to write. Really interesting.
Well, I bet. I mean, when I was writing my own book called The Green Man, it like I said, it set many, many, many centuries ago in the 14th century. But when I was doing my own research, it was fascinating to dip into that those ancient myths and look at the landscape and how the landscape is interpreted by varying generations and ongoing generations of people. Right. Well, I think you were going. Were you going to mention the cleaving?
Yes. Well, this ties in quite nicely. This is an Arthurian novel, which frankly I never expected to write. But I was having a conversation with an editor who sort of said, "Have you ever thought about writing Arthurian novels?" And my response was, "No." And he said, "Well, why not?" And I basically said, "Well, toxic masculinity, overarching patriarchy, rape culture. How many anti-feminist themes would you like me to list?" And he went, "Excellent." And I said, "Excuse me?" And he said, "I think, you know, there's definitely time for a re-examination of that whole..." Because, again, this brings us back to a lot of the unexplored roots of modern epic fantasy fiction, that if a lot of these elements have been carried over into epic secondary world fiction without in many cases being sufficiently explored. You know, the damsel in the distress, the white knight on the charger who comes galloping up and swoops her off. You know, you can draw a line from Geoffrey of Monmouth through the 1400s and French romantic poetry and all the rest of it. And then you've got Walter Scott, who is, again, there's an awful lot of Walter Scott's assumptions and ideas that seep into a lot of the modern epic fantasy that's written, and these ideas need exploring. So I went back and read the source text for Arthur, in particular Malory, for the first time in decades, and things that had never struck me at the time struck me, you know, slapped me between the eyes on this rereading. The tensions, well, for a start, the extent to which the landscape is fluid, it is not fixed. There are places like Camelot. Where is Camelot? Nobody knows where Camelot is. Arthur is supposedly one of the archetypal foundation myth of Britain, and yet so much of it relates to France and the continent. And fairy and strange, there's a lot of magic in it. There are umpteen magic swords. Excalibur is only the start of it. There are all sorts of them. It is the whole myth setup, the whole myth corpus is so strange and in many ways incoherent. But again, frequently it's tied to the landscape, and the land is important. Particularly once you get into the whole, the king is the land and the land is the king.
Well, yes, I feel like I have to, you mentioned toxic masculinity and the patriarchy, but I feel sometimes when these things are mentioned, I feel like I have to step in and defend the patriarchy sometimes, because it's only when the patriarchy is corrupted by the bad king that it becomes toxic. And the idea is that you get the noble king at the top of the patriarchy so that the land can be revivified, and Arthur is the king and the king is the land, and
it still sucks to be a girl, because basically and when I started looking at some of the female characters in the myth. And again, if you look at the myth as classically presented, both in the text and also in subsequent film and TV versions, of which there are many, 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 the female characters only ever come and go in and out of the myth in service to the core male gaze, male focused narrative. Igraine, Arthur's mother, Nimue, who may or may not be a sorceress. I mean, there are lots of inconsistencies in different versions, so it was actually quite useful, because you can, you know, take what works for what you're doing. Morgana, the other princesses, the other queens, whose sons variously get slaughtered or go out and do some slaughtering. And actually, if you start looking at where these women will be when they are, if you like, off screen, they are going to be in the same places. They're going to be overlapping. They are going to have relationships that are entirely independent of the core male-focused narrative. And that, the more I looked at that, the more interesting a narrative I could devise, seeing the classic, you know, from Arthur's birth and the trickery with Merlin and what Merlin does right through to the Battle of Camlann. If you start looking at that from the point of view of the women who are affected by those events, you get a very, very different perspective on the whole thing.
So, this is what the cleaving essentially is doing.
And one of the things that that's coming out May next year, May 23, from Angry Robot. And one of the things that actually then, as I was constructing this narrative, became apparent to me was you can actually not only flag up how toxic masculinity, even benevolent patriarchy, means it sucks to be a girl, but actually it doesn't do the guys many favours either.
Well, I would say that
It's good
if war is the default state of the nation, then unless you're the actual king yourself, then it ain't going to be that great if you're a guy either.
No, and the whole Arthurian mythos is basically a if you look at the sort of the way the narrative unfolds, it is a semi-permanent state of war, which is a very, very corrosive thing.
And I think I would possibly say that that's, you know, partly metaphorical for the state of the nation. And in any mythological text, it's about the revivification of the land, the revivification of the state in the face of corruption. And the corruption either comes from without or within. It doesn't really matter. But a bit like Blood in the Mist, when the citizens become so one-eyed that they're not, they consider that the corruption doesn't even exist, that's at the exact point when you're most susceptible and most vulnerable to it. So you have to be open to, well, to new information in order to revivify the state. And that happens in Arthur, that happens in the Osiris myth in Egypt, it happens in Christian myth as well, and you know, everywhere else you look. So the war, it's a good metaphor, is war, for conflict, isn't it? It's there in all of our modern fantasy books as well, from Tolkien through to everything else. So I think the war, it is, I suppose you could say it's corrosive, because it's not great if you're a man, because the chances are you're going to get sent off to some godforsaken hill to die very violently alone. And it's not going to be great for the women either back home, who are left with their own relationships to pick up. And there's a rich vein. Let's just say that rich vein there. Interesting. It does raise the question. There's a strong sense of feminist retellings of, what would you say, classical stories?
Yeah, it's a real thing at the moment.
Mm. Is it? Do you think there's a danger that it's just a fashion, or can these retellings become as well? Can they establish themselves as mythological canon in their own right?
I see no reason why they shouldn't, because mythic retellings, again, the Arthurian corpus is there were feminist retellings of Arthurian myth happening in the 1400s. Marie de France and other writers who basically don't get the prominence that they deserve. I think one of the things that is happening with a lot of the current reimaginings of classic myth is modern contemporary writers are unpicking the Victorian overlay. And one of the, the Arthurian cycle is one of the classic examples, that if you look at what the Victorians did with the myth, basically they reformulated an awful lot of myth in service of their own worldview, which is, he for God, he for God alone, she for God in him, and we are the British and we have a God-given right to rule any empire, stick down a flag and call this place Piccadilly. And Actually, if you go back, because I did classics as my degree, and if you start looking at the myths from the point of view of why the Greeks were telling these myths and why the Romans were telling these myths, but again, because the classics became the bedrock of English public school education, and that comes from the Enlightenment, when thinkers wanted to find authoritative texts from the past that weren't the Bible to use to support their worldview, so that we are not going to be governed by the Catholic Church or indeed the Protestant churches that are emerging, but you know, we want the stamp of authority from ancient texts, and we're going to nab them from the Greeks and the Romans. And so actually I think there's a lot of scope for looking at these myths and stripping away. It's a bit like stripping layers and layers of wallpaper off or varnish. You know, anytime you've done any redecorating or repainting, you know, you can sort of see the history of whoever's lived in particularly if you've ever lived in an old house, and stripped away layers and layers and layers of wallpaper until you actually get back to the the plaster with horsehair in it. Because I've lived in houses that old. And then you can start afresh and you can see what that means for you now. And I think that's a lot of what's going on.
Well, it's been great talking to you. I think it's been a fascinating talk. I think we've covered quite a lot of good ground. So
I think so.
Before we draw to a close, I'm just going to ask our usual final couple of questions, which is, what are you reading now? And what would be your one recommended book for our listeners?
At the moment, I am rereading Lois McMaster Bujold's For Kosigan books.
Oh, well, that's quite appropriate, given the cleaving, isn't it?
Yes, and because basically there is so much going on in the world, and it's also a bit grim. They are my respite from the news and the doom scrolling at the moment, and I have just finished reading Memory, which means I can't remember what the next one up is, but I shall be starting that at bedtime tonight. Books to recommend. Well, in the context of the conversation we've had today about modern myth making and fairy tales and looking at fairy tales anew from a new perspective, it's got to be the In the Heart of Hidden Things by Kit Whitfield, with a supplementary shout out for Liz Williams and the Fallow Sisters novel, which the first one of those is Comet Weather. And I couldn't choose between those, actually, frankly, at the moment.
They sound like great recommendations.
They are very interesting books and quite unlike anything that the majority of reading that's on offer at the moment.
Well, I will definitely have a look at those in that case. Julia, it's been lovely having you on. I really enjoyed it. I think we had a great conversation, and hopefully this will drive a few people to try out Lud in the Mist.
Yes, it's definitely worth a read, because one of the things is actually, because it isn't a shaped, crafted, modern novel, it's full of surprises and unexpected twists. Because as a reader and a writer, yeah, I'm pretty good at working out where things are going because I've had so much experience. No, basically, ideas get picked up, dropped, reappear, don't reappear. This book is full of surprises.
We'll leave it there. Thanks ever so much for joining us.
You're entirely welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Lovely. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
This episode of Kronzcast was brought to you by Dan Jones and our special guest, Juliet E. McKenna. Additional content was provided by Damaris Brown, Christopher Bean, Brian Sexton, Jay Starlipper, Doug Van Arten, and Joe Zebedee. Special thanks to Brian Turner and all the staff at Cron's, and thanks to you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to Cron's Cast, and don't forget to join the world's largest science fiction and fantasy community for free at sffchronicles.com. Join us next month when we'll be talking to the award-winning author Stephen Hall to talk about his smash hit debut novel, the wildly inventive and genre-bending The Rorschach Texts.